The title of this talk, The Real Miracle, was given by Gil Fronsdell on May 28, 2007. It's based on the middle-length discourses, number 123.
So, we're a smaller group than usual, which could allow us to do Monday evening a little bit different than me holding forth here with a talk. So I'm prepared to give a talk, a rather unusual talk, so you're warned. Or we could all kind of sit closer and we could have a discussion, kind of an intimate tête-à-tête. You can ask questions and we can discuss the Dharma in some way together. What would you like?
Both.
Which parts of both?
Well, the talk sounds very intriguing. It piques my curiosity. But I also like the idea of talking too. So maybe you could do part of your talk and then maybe that would stimulate things.
A little bit of all. I think the talk, I don't know how long the talk's going to take, but once I start, I have to get through the end of it. So I can't just kind of, sometimes talks, doesn't matter where you end them. But this talk, has an ending that you need to get to as a punchline.
Go for the talk.
Go for the talk? Yeah. It's risky because it's reading from this book, and it's a sutta, and it's a sutta might be boring. And it also might, it's really strange, this text. And so it's a different ways of interpreting it. So I kind of thought about this because on Sunday we're celebrating Buddha's birthday. And so at first I thought, I'll come Monday night we always celebrate Buddha's birthday, the Vesak, on Sunday. And every time we do it, I tell some aspect of the Buddha's life story. But I never do it Monday, because we don't celebrate Vesak on Monday. This year I'll come in down and say something about Buddha's life. And then I got a little bit bored in my mind, the Buddha's life again. So I thought, I'll tell you part of his life story that comes from the suttas, from the ancient discourses, that it's a rather bizarre text about his life. You know what the word hagiography is? Hagiography is the stories of saints. It's how they're, how wonderful the saints are. So all religions seem to have hagiographies. And Buddhism has that as well. So there's all these myths, amazing stories, miracle stories and things that are told about the Buddha. And here in our tradition, generally we tend to focus on the Buddha as being a historical person, and we're kind of down to earth, and Buddhism being kind of, for ordinary people, and we kind of dispense with a lot of the part of the tradition which is kind of supernatural. But that it is there in the Buddhist tradition. You can't, it's there. And the question is, what do we do with it that's there? And I know some very prominent teachers have asked them, what do you do with this part in here? And they say, we just ignore it. And so we're kind of, we're partly the ignoring school. And you can argue, this is later additions. As the centuries as Buddhism existed in India, this hagiographic material kind of crept in. And it's a later corruption, it's a later kind of fantasy that people put in. It was later propaganda, because in order to kind of for Buddhism to survive in its Indian environment, it had to kind of show that its founder was as great as other religions' great founders. They had their wonderful hagiographies, great stories, miracle stories of their founders. And so Buddhism had to show that their teacher was just as great, right? Otherwise, it doesn't count. So who knows? There's all these interpretations of why this exists. And so I'm going to read part of it, and hopefully you'll stay. But you have to kind of hang in there for the punchline. And I think the punchline is, for me, makes the whole thing humorous, in part. And also, my image is that some monks and nuns were sitting around, and they were kind of like jibing each other with these kind of like, look what my teacher, my founder, what he was able to do. Look what he was able to do. And then they add this what I think. You'll probably fall flat on you until I explain it, but the zinger at the end. Are you ready? With that kind of... So the monks are sitting around talking and with Ananda, and they're saying how wonderful the Buddha is. It's how wonderful he is. How mighty and powerful is the Buddha. For he's able to know about the Buddhas of the past, who've attained nirvana, and all about, he can look into the past and remember past Buddhas, the eons and eons ago. Isn't that wonderful? It's a miracle. And Ananda says, yeah, he's really wonderful. He has wonderful qualities. The Buddha is marvelous and has marvelous qualities. However, their discussion was interrupted by the Buddha. And he asked, what are you guys talking about? And so they said, oh, we're talking about how great you are. And so the Buddha said, oh, is that so? Well, then explain further, Ananda. Explain more fully the Buddha's wonderful and marvelous qualities. And there's a refrain that's repeated over and over again. So I'll read it the first maybe once or twice, and then it's kind of imagine it's there. So Ananda says, I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. So this is what he says. I heard this. This is what the Buddha said. This is what you said. Mindful and fully aware, Ananda, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, appeared in Tusita heaven. That mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva appeared in Tusita heaven. This I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha. So as the myth goes, before a Buddha, before anybody becomes a Buddha, in their penultimate lifetime, they are born in this very prestigious heaven called Tusita heaven. And they kind of live up there kind of quite delightedly. And that's just how the order of the universe is set up. That before you become a Buddha, you have to spend, one lifetime up there in Tusita heaven. So, I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva remained in Tusita heaven, remained there. So he was born there and then he remained there. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisattva remained in this heaven. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven. He died up there and descended into his mother's womb. This too is a wonderful quality. When the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. And in this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and people. So now the monks are kind of winking. Can you believe this? This is a great story we're telling. And even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. And the beings born there perceived each other by that light. So other beings indeed have appeared here. And then 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. It's getting pretty interesting. So the when the Buddha gets when the conception happens and Buddha goes into the womb, there's this amazing light that fills the darkest spaces of the universe, and all these different world systems and cosmoses and whatever, and the earth shakes. So the monks are sitting around by a campfire winking. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasures, from false speech, from wines, liqueurs, and intoxicants. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no sensual thought arose in her concerning men, and she was inaccessible to any man having a lustful mind. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she obtained the 5 cords of sensual pleasure, and furnished and endowed with them, she enjoyed herself with them. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no kind of affliction arose in her. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. Suppose a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread was strung through a fine beryl gem. Beryl? Beryl? Is that pronounced it? I guess it's a kind of a transparent gem. Of purest water, 8 faceted, well cut, and a person with good eyesight were to take it in his or her hand and review it thus. This is a fine beryl gem of purest water, 8 faceted, well cut, and through it strung a blue, yellow, red, white, and blue thread. So too, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she saw within her womb that he had all his limbs, lacking no faculty. So it goes on and on with these wonderful qualities of the Buddha. Are you bored? Are you wishing we did the other option this evening now? Near the discussion? 7 days after the birth of the Buddha, his mother died, and she reappeared into Sita heaven. Other women gave birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 months, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. She carried him for 10 months. Other women gave birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. She did it standing up. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first gods received him, then human beings. When he came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. 4 young gods received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O queen, a son of great power has been born to you." When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water or blood or any kind of impurity, clean and unsullied. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, 2 jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. This too is a wonderful and marvelous quality. This too is a miracle. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took 7 steps north, and with a white parasol held over him, he surveyed each quarter of the world and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. "I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost of the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewal of being for me." That's pretty amazing. I mean, first the 7 steps, and then this, you know, staying, you know, "I'm the best." Like Muhammad Ali, right? "I'm the best." So this story, a slightly version of it, I say every time I teach the Buddha's birth story to children, I say that he was born, and I say he took 7 steps, and then he made a statement, you know, he said, a little different version, "Heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world honored one, I'm the best." And then I say, this is it's because it's used in Zen, I say, this is a kind of a Zen story. And the way you're supposed to use this story is you have to understand that you can say this for yourself, and that each person can in some set way say that they are themselves wonderful and special, the best. Not just in the eyes of their parents, but you know that somehow that each person is so precious and so valuable, that each person is the best person, the most wonderful person. So I don't know what I'm conditioning these young kids, but I hope it's a good one. And then sometimes when I've done it in classrooms and stuff, when my kid was in preschool, I'd go around and point to each kid and say their name. "You're the best. You're the best. You're the best." And it was partly the idea that they feel like they're a little bit special, but also that everyone else is special as well. So anyway, so we use these myths sometimes for other purposes. So remember, there's a punchline coming, right? You have to put up with, you have to kind of feel it. You have to feel the crescendo, the tension, the marvel, the miracle. Go, wow. You have to almost like believe it. Like, wow, can you believe it? You know, wow, this is amazing. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people. And even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. So it goes on. Okay? So we're almost done with the miracles. So you have to kind of be on the edge of your seat. This being so, so now Ananda has finished his story. Buddha asked Ananda to recount the wonderful qualities, the miracle qualities of the Buddha. And then Ananda has done this. And now he's finished. And so now the Buddha jumps in again. Have you heard all this? It's Buddha's turn to reply or to... And the Buddha says, "That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha." So he's heard all these wonderful things said about him. And so now, I'm going to tell you one more thing that you should remember that's really marvelous. It's a miracle. Here, Ananda, for the Buddha, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a marvelous and wonderful quality of the Buddha. That's the punchline. So you can imagine, you know, either they're sitting around having a great grand old time at the campfire, these monks and nuns, and it's kind of making these wonderful, you know, making up these stories about the Buddhas, you know. Or who knows why these stories are there. Maybe the Buddha made them up. But it's all these wonderful, marvelous miracles. This is my interpretation. All these wonderful, marvelous miracle stories are setting you up to take you by surprise by what's really marvelous, the miracle of it all. And that is a Buddha, when a thought arises, he sees the arising of a thought, he sees that it's there for a while, and he sees its passing. He sees a feeling arise, sees it's there for a while, he sees its passing. He sees perception of something arise, persist, and pass away. That is the ultimate miracle. It's kind of like in Zen. They sometimes kind of talk about miracles in Zen too. They hear these Buddhist miracle stories. In Zen they might say, the real miracle is chopping wood and carrying water. This is a little bit different, right? So this whole story is a kind of setup to build up this tension so that when you hear this final piece of the story, it gets your attention. Oh, because if someone said, you know, it's marvelous to be able to see thoughts arise and pass away, you know, well, yes, but here it's kind of putting it next to these amazing miracle stories. This is really significant. To be able to have the mindfulness, the presence, the concentration to watch the arising of a thought is persisting and passing away. So why is that? Why is that so special? There's a variety of reasons. A lot of things come from this kind of insight. First, I might say that this kind of insight doesn't come easily. Because to kind of in a very clear, precise way, see something, a thought arise, persist and pass away, is not our usual mode of being aware of thoughts. Often we're caught up in the thoughts, and our thoughts sometimes are obsessive, compulsive. They have a certain weight and importance to them. We're caught up in the ideas of them. It's kind of like going to a movie. And the movies may be really fascinating and captures you, and it's scary and you get scared, and something funny happens and you laugh, and you fall in love with the heroes and heroines, and you can't wait, you know, it's just so real. And And then someone slows down the projector. And you know, so there's one frame goes up on the screen and it's frozen there for 10 seconds, and then the next frame goes up, and the next frame goes up, and you realize that it just still pictures up there. And because they're going fast, they look like movement and activity, but actually it's just a lot of still frames. And you realize, you know, well, this heroine that I fell in love with, I mean, it's just an actress there, it's just a story that's being told. And you don't, if you're enchanted and you love the story, you don't want the projector to be slowed down. You don't want to be shown the truth. That this is just, you know, these still shots, you know, there's kind of optical illusion in the mind that kind of, the mind kind of makes it into movement. And however, in daily life, our mind sometimes operates the same way. That we don't see how things come into being, how things arise and pass away. So we're caught up in the drama of it all. We're caught up in the stories as if this is it. And when the mind gets very strongly concentrated, very calm and strong mindfulness, it becomes a little bit akin to slowing down the movie picture. You actually see the arising of a thought, the floating by and going away. And you can feel it as being very, very different experience than having a thought arise and latching onto it. And adding another thought on top of it, or reacting to it, and doing all these things with our thoughts. And they say sometimes that you can watch thoughts arise and float through the mind like clouds in an empty sky. So thought kind of goes through, and you know, you just kind of has. It's almost like it has no power over you, no authority over you. It doesn't push you around. It does not like billiard balls that kind of, you know, you hit one ball and it hits the other and that hits another and that's another. You know, the mind sometimes is like billiard balls. You have one thought, it bumps into another and creates another thought. But when you see the thought arise and pass in a very kind of calm way, it has no continuity of movement and motion in the mind. And you get a very different perspective on the thoughts that you have, or the feelings that arise and pass, or the perceptions that arise and pass. And it said that kind of clear perception of the rising and passing is very liberating because it's for a variety of reasons. One reason is that it's very hard to cling to something you see as being arising and passing. You know, you see it's almost like transparent it is, or see how light it is, or see how, some people say, empty it is. It has no power over you. Now, some people might complain and say, well, I want to go back to the enchantment. Speed up the movie again, because I prefer to be enchanted. Enchanted is very closely connected to being deluded, you know, to be under a spell. And there might be pleasure in enchantment, but there's also danger in enchantment. The Chinese painter who spent a long time painting a very realistic dragon. And then he stepped back to take a look at what he'd created. And he saw the dragon as a whole for the first time, and he got frightened and ran away. So sometimes our mind can create amazing images, you know, that we believe and get caught and we get frightened by. And some of them have to do about the world around us. Sometimes it has to do about ourselves. We create whole worlds, images, pictures of who we are, and we frighten ourselves. Or we abhor ourselves, or we're critical of ourselves, or we build ourselves up in some kind of conceitful way. That's not very realistic and set up for suffering. So to speed up the film again and get re-enchanted is a setup to suffer again, to take our thoughts to being really serious and weighty. And so to be able to kind of see the arising of a thought and let it just be arising, just be a thought that appears. You don't have to even say it's my thought. You don't have to believe the thought. It might be a good thought, but you don't have to believe it. You don't have to assume that because a thought arises, because you think something, that has to result in something happening because of it. I have to react to it. I have to believe it. I have to do something about it. I have to fix it, something. I should fix it or something. Just a thought arises, and it goes away. You see it's arising and passing. Whatever is nature of being born into existence has a nature to pass away. And you really see that arising and passing. And seeing the rising and passing, then the mind has less and less tendency to cling. And as it releases its tendency to cling, the consciousness, the mind, is set free. Consciousness is set loose, in a sense, from its, the shackle, the fetters, of being tied to thoughts, perceptions, feelings, the way that consciousness is often shackled or tied or connected. This is not a dismissal of thoughts. It's not a dismissal of feelings and perceptions. In fact, very clearly in the Buddhist tradition, it said, when a person sees the arising of phenomena, they can no longer hold the view, a nihilistic worldview, a view that somehow or other dismisses or sees phenomena as being non-existent or sees phenomena as being a dream. However, when you see the passing of phenomena, you can no longer take phenomena as being permanent, as being substantial, as being, you know, fixed. And the idea of permanence, the whole philosophy of permanence, can't be sustained in the mind because you see it passing away as well. And back in the time of the Buddha, there were two very prominent philosophies of religion. One was more nihilistic, that nothing exists and nothing counts, everything just disappears once and for all. And another philosophy of permanence. There's a permanent soul, there's a permanence to this world, there's a permanence to certain things. And that was a worldview. And the Buddha said, no, if a person clearly sees that everything in your experience has a nature of arising and passing away, you'll take neither the extreme of nihilism nor the extreme of permanence. And rather you'll see what's called the emptiness of phenomena. But here, the emptiness of phenomena here is not meant to be vacuous. It's meant to be somehow transparent or not insubstantial in the sense that it doesn't count, but insubstantial as it's not something that's worthy of clinging to, of holding on to, or making a stand, standing on something. This is what I believe. So one of the delusions that I've seen that I've fallen into periodically is the delusion of permanence. And so, for example, it happens with my kids all the time. My kid is going through some kind of difficulty. And in my mind kind of has this idea, this is it. This is the difficulty he's going to have for the rest of his life. And, you know, if I think about it, I realize that's not the case. But I'm operating this kind of vague delusion of permanence. This is it. And I've seen it over and over and over with my kids. That, this is it. This is the way it's going to be. I got it. And then the next day or the next hour or next month, they're in a whole new phase of their life and things change. And, you know. So, you know, like there was a 9-year change. My son became so, you know, finally became settled after 9 years, settled and calm and, you know, friendly and helpful. And I couldn't believe it was the same kid. Oh, finally, we got a good kid now. That's great. This is it. Well, you know, and now he's into a little bit different phase where I'm starting to realize he has, you know, complicated, more private psychology going on. You know, it's a private psychological world. It wasn't so private before. And he's mulling over things and concerned about things. And so, oh no, this is what we have now. Delusion of permanence. Oh no. It's going to be this way forever. And I've had this with myself. Certain feelings arise. You know, I get feeling kind of blue. Oh, I'll be blue forever. When I was 20, I remember having this really ecstatic summer. And at the end of the summer, I told a friend of mine, I'll never be depressed again. And then that fall, I was more depressed than I'd ever been in my life. I'll be depressed forever. So anyway, so the delusion of permanence, but also the delusion that nothing counts. The insight into the rising and passing is supposed to somehow help you overcome both the dismissal of reality and an excessive clinging to it, both at the same time. So you see the arising and passing of things. So you see the rising of a thought. You see the passing of it. And it's, often our thoughts are claustrophobic. And we're so caught in the story and the drama, it's hard actually to step back enough to see, oh, this is a thought that's arising. We're living in the thought. But if you don't live in the thought, then step back and watch it. And if your mind is calm enough, you can see it arise and pass. Then you might be able to be aware that there's space between your thoughts. And then there's a very interesting question you can ask yourself. And the question is, who are you when you're not thinking? Well, then you can answer the question with another thought. Oh, I am Gil. Well, that's a thought. But who are you when you're not thinking? Oh, you know, I'm a Dharma teacher. Or I am a nice person, nice guy. Or I am a lousy person. I'm, you know, embarrassment to humankind. Whatever, you know. But as soon as you say a thought like that, it's a thought. Who are you when you're not thinking? My guess is most of the ways in which you suffer around your self-identity, those of you who suffer some way or other about self-identities, you know, some concept of self, it happens through the medium, through the vehicle of your thinking. And if you're not thinking, but you're awake and alert and aware and present, and you're not thinking those thoughts, then who are you? And some people might say, well, yes, I'm not those thoughts, I don't believe those thoughts, but those feelings of mine are so heavy and dark. But then you see the arising and passing of your feeling. Who are you when you're not having a feeling? Oh no, I can't go there. Because feeling is so closely tied to who I really am that it just seems nihilistic not to have feelings. You're telling me not to have any feelings? No. But do you really want to define yourself by the feelings you're having? What if you step back from those and watch those arise and pass? And who are you when you're alert, present, clear, here, transparent, but there's not a feeling? Well, I'd be blah. No, that's a feeling. Oh, I'd feel kind of lost. That's a feeling. You can see that feeling of lostness arise, and you might see it pass. Who are you when you're not having a feeling? Who are you when you're not having a perception? In the space between perceptions, perception arises, it passes. Who are you? You're aware, alert, energized, present, and there's a space between perceptions. I mean, there's no perception, do you not exist? Is it blank? No. What is that? So, one of the things is that it's non-referential. So, like your eyes. So we can all try to do an experiment here. I think you all have good enough eyesight for this. So use your eyes, look at something. Now, try to see your eyes. Can you see your eyes? What happens when you look for your eyes when you're looking? I mean, if you're really fast, turn your head fast. There's no self-referential ability in the eyes themselves to see themselves. It's kind of like if you try to look behind your eyes with your eyes, you can't really say you see anything. There's just this great space or it's great something. You know, you're there, right? I mean, all this mental functioning is going on right behind the eyes. But, you know, you can't see it. There's this transparency or translucidity. There's nothing to cling to because you can't see it. So, I don't know if that experiment kind of points to it, but it's kind of like that. You exist and things arise and pass, but you don't take the arising and passing of things as a place where you hook your identity, claim this is who I really am. But also you don't take that transparent awareness, open awareness as who I am either, because, two reasons. Because to do that requires you to think. And then you're actually holding on to the thought, or requires you to perceive, and then you're holding on to the perception. And because you might also be aware that this translucent, transparent awareness also arises and passes too. this is not to leave us diminished, this insight, but to be enhanced. So enhanced that the people who follow you might, when they hear about you, might sit around the campfire and say about you, let me tell you about the marvelous and wonderful qualities of this person who was free. And it was free. She was free because she could see the arising, the sustaining, and the passing of these ordinary phenomena that make up our human life. Perceptions, feelings, thoughts, and all that. And that's really a miracle, to have that ability. All the rest, earlier stuff, that's just fluff. We don't have to ever talk about it again. And I probably never will in a Dharma talk. So, that's the story for today. I hope that you made the right choice at the beginning of the evening. You'll never know. So, thank you very much.